Exploring Mormon Thought features discussions about Mormon doctrine and theology that correlate with topics in the book series of the same name written by scholar and theologian Blake Osler. Find us online at exploringmormonthought.com and facebook.com/exploringmormonthought. Hi, listeners. Welcome back to Exploring Mormon Thought. Today we're continuing with Fire on the Horizon, and this chapter is called The Peer Relationship as Christology. So we talked about the last little bit about how in Joseph Smith's revelations and his insights into, or in breakthroughs, I guess we could say, into the divine life and what it means to have a relationship with God and how the temple ordinances point to that. So as the title says, we're going to talk about how this peer relationship that we sort of alluded to, you know, when we talked about the I-Thou relationship, how that can turn into an LDS Christology. And so we've talked about most of this stuff before in other podcasts, but this is going to kind of be a distilled version of that. So we started out as usual with a quote from the book from you. You say, Joseph Smith saw that God did not seek a relationship of master to subject, nor of owner to slave. Instead, he had the gall to teach that God seeks genuine peers. It was the most astounding insight of his prophetic vision, because we are of the same genus and species as God. A genuine relationship is possible, because of that, between God and humans. So, I'm sure most people know surface level of this, and we've talked about it before, like I said, but go into why that was so revolutionary. What was before him some of the more traditional views of the human-God relationship?
In the Islamic and Christian traditions, and prominently also in some parts, for instance, with Maimonides, who was a Jewish philosopher, the relationship between God and humans is that of that brought forth from absolute nothing. Our dependence is total, and God's mode of being, that is his the nature of existence, where he cannot not exist. He cannot fail to exist logically. And humans depend on God to maintain them in existence in each moment, led to not merely a subservient relationship, but a relationship where the nature of deity could never, ever be equated with human nature in any way. It would be impossible for a human to ever bridge this. It's called the ontological gulf, from ontos, which is the Greek verb meaning to be, but it is to be in a very specific way. It's the way that God exists uncaused and without any dependence on anything else for his existence, whereas humans are caused and depend on something else for their existence in every moment. That was the traditional view for the people of the book, that is, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And it led to a very different kind of relationship with God than that was later posited by Joseph Smith. The genius is that, I mean, and this is the most astounding fact, in my view, in all of Christian history. The best minds in Christian thought spent literally centuries and reams and councils and attempt after attempt to reconcile how it is that Jesus Christ could be both truly a human and also truly divine at the same time. And of course, due to the ontological gulf, it is just the logical impossibility, because the nature of being of divinity is so distinct from the nature of being a human being. Their ontological distinctness means that they can never be equated, or this difference can't be gulfed. One cannot simply become a god by just living for a very long time. The very nature of being is different. And so in this moment, Joseph Smith is doing two things. He's resolving essentially the most intractable problems of a Christology. That is, how is it we explain that Christ is both human and divine at the same time? And he's also resolving the notion of deification or Christification, in which human beings truly become divine. Now, it's prominent in Eastern Orthodox theology and in some views of Catholic theology to say that human beings, you know, their goal, their destiny is to become gods, but they really don't mean that. Even in saying it, what they really mean is that we will participate in the glory of God, and we will be glorified to some extent by that participation, but the kind of being that we have will never be that of God. And so saying that we're deified means that a deific power is in us, but it doesn't mean we become gods even in the remotest sense, if one is being honest. With this change, Joseph Smith is opening the way for us to truly be not merely, you know, gods who participate in God's glory, but truly gods in every sense. We will possess every power, every knowledge, every property that God has of divinity. We will share in a fullness in the same way that he does. There will be no distinction in the nature of our being. It's neither stroke of genius nor simple luck. I take it to be sheer revelation, but it simply dissolves the most intractable problems created in Christian theology. And that somebody like Joseph Smith would simply dissolve the problem with such a recognition is astounding to me. Clearly, it was not the result of a theological analysis that caused him to arrive at this conclusion.
Okay, so just to recap, so what you're saying is people were having problems understanding, like, well, if Christ is God, and we have all these categories for God, like, you know, and he's has to always exist, and then he's a human, and that's weird because humans came into existence, and there was also the problem of Christ being the only begotten Son. Like, well, if he's begotten, then he's, you know, dependent on the Father and not equal with the Father. And so you're saying Joseph Smith, rather than trying to somehow bring Christ into a, I don't know, somehow explain how he's merely human while still being a God, he brought all of humanity up to the same level, saying, like, well, you know what, we can say everybody is also a god and also human because we're gods having a human experience, which is what he kind of, what his Christology was, where it is God and he is having a human experience. So he's like, but that's what everyone's doing. So that is quite an astounding move to raise what was regarded previously in every other Christian religion, or, you know, like you said, religion of the book. Like you said, he's bridging the gulf, saying we're all on that level.
Exactly and precisely. We are truly divine spiritual beings having a mortal experience, not mortals sometimes having spiritual experiences. And so this is the very essence of the breakthrough that Joseph Smith made. Now, it has several very important corollaries or implications, if you will, the first of which is this, and this is also what Joseph Smith's revelation is based upon. Godhood is not dependent solely on one's individual existence. While salvation is a matter of what we do individually, exaltation and deification are a family matter, and they involve everyone in the human family who's ever existed or ever will exist. And so to be fully divine is to be in a relationship of complete indwelling love. Now, this is an important term, indwelling. In the Gospel of John, to go back, he uses two words, in and hen, in and one, to say that we are one in each other. And he literally means that our personal glory indwells in each other, and we glorify each other in virtue of living our lives in each other. Christ takes up abode in us, and we become true Christians. But the realization also means this. To be divine isn't a matter of one's own status, rather, because of the nature of this interpersonal relationship, this loving relationship, that what we're here to learn to do is to love. In other words, we're here to learn to become divine. And we become divine by perfecting our ability to love. God is divine in virtue of this love. God is love, literally in the sense that it is the loving relationship of the divine persons that makes them divine. And the most astounding fact in all of the universe is that we have been invited fully into this relationship. This is the basis for the gospel. God seeks to have us enter into this relationship to share everything that he has and be everything that he is, to be one just as the Father and the Son are one, just as the Gospel of John repeatedly says. And I think that the only full recognition of what the Gospel of John is teaching is Joseph Smith's view, that we can fully enter into this relationship and be everything that they are because ontologically, that is, in our mode of being, we are what they are. We're uncreated in our ultimate being. We have the very same kind of capacities that they do. The difference between us and God is not the nature of whether we're created or uncreated. The distinction is whether we have chosen love in each moment of our existence. Each of the divine persons, the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost, has from all eternity. We have not. So the difference is this free choice, not some kind of ontological reality about us. When we truly love to love one another, as the Son has invited us to love just as he does, then we will be in the same kind of relationship that he is with the Father. That is a fullness of divine relationship, and we will be one just as they are one in the Godhead. And we will be invited and will be part of the Godhead in every respect. There is no difference whatsoever. However, it may be that the individual divine persons will surpass where they are now, and they will invite us to join them in the surpassing glory that they will have then created as well. So the bottom line is that there are no distinctions, ultimately, if we choose to love. And that's what the entire gospel is about. The reason that this is so is that it is the realization of human nature, the fullness of to be fully human is to be fully divine, and to be fully divine is to fully love. And so the purpose of the gospel is to teach us this love. It just so happens that our greatest happiness, our greatest enjoyment and fulfillment, the greatest realization of everything that we are is realized in interpersonal loving relationships where we give ourselves to each other so that we are in the beloved and the beloved is in us. It's a new way of life that goes beyond the kind of alienated, isolated relationship that we have as human beings on this earth. When we enter into this type of relationship, we realize the fullness of our humanity. And in realizing the fullness of our humanity, we realize the fullness of our divinity. This is an amazing realization that I think is really made only realistically and logically possible by Joseph Smith's view of the ontological relationship between humans and the divine persons.
Okay, and with that, so to make a distinction between what you're saying was more what the scriptures point to and what Joseph Smith was getting at, as opposed to some strains of Latter-day Saint thought. So in some strains of, you know, our church, and some of this stems from Brigham Young and things like that, but a lot of people are kind of under the impression that when you get exalted, that kind of means that you then become God and you're separate, if you will, from this God that you have now, or that they kind of use the analogy of like you grow up and then you go and like you know you're in the house of your father, your earthly father. Eventually you grow up and you go and you make your own house that's separate. So what you're saying is not that. You're saying it's you are coming into a relationship more like, I don't know, I guess you could say, I think I've used this analogy before, but it's more like, well, sort of like this. Two things. So there's a Godhead and they have this cool relationship that's like the perfect indwelling relationship. And you're saying we're being invited into that relationship. So it's almost like a, not like a club, but let's just use that analogy of like some cool secret club where you have to have, you know, they have certain standards. Like if you want to get in our club, you have to be this, this, and this. And if you can do that, then you're in the club. Is that kind of more what you have in mind? And I know that's kind of a crude analogy, but just,
well, it is a crude analogy, but I think it works insofar as it goes. And like all analogies, it breaks down badly at some point. So, but it works to that extent. What we're saying is more like the analogy of H2O in water. So the atoms of oxygen and hydrogen that make up water, when they're individual atoms, don't have any of the properties of water. They can't really, you know, you can't find anything like water in them. But when they form a molecular unity, they form water, two atoms of hydrogen, one atom of oxygen. Now, that doesn't change the essential nature of the atoms themselves, but something emerges from that relationship, which is far beyond their mere personal properties. When they are in this relationship, they have properties of water that are life-sustaining that neither hydrogen nor oxygen have alone. And so they become something very different in unity that emerges from their relationship than they are all alone. And it's the same with us in relationship to the Godhead. Now, I'm not saying that we're constituent parts of God, but I do say that we remain individuals while we are nevertheless in this interpersonal relationship. To make this a little more understandable, and this goes along with both Christology and the theory of atonement, one of the unique aspects of the atonement in Mormon thought is that it not only did something for human beings, it also did something for God. That is, God truly learned how to succor his people. He learned from the things that he suffered and truly learned to overcome alienation and isolation and the kind of aloneness and rejection that we feel as human beings. It's part of our human nature. When, for instance, Christ separated himself from the Godhead so that he was not part of this indwelling unity, he didn't participate in the fullness of divinity in the same way that an atom of oxygen doesn't participate in the properties of water when it's just an atom of oxygen. It's just an atom of oxygen without the additional properties. And it was the same with Christ. He didn't have the additional properties of the fullness of divinity when he became a human being. And so he learned from his experience what it was. It was something, in fact, he couldn't possibly experience logically as a member of the Godhead. It would be logically impossible for a member of the Godhead to experience what it is like to be alienated, isolated, alone, rejected. And the reason for that is that to be in the Godhead is to be in the most fulfilling, loving relationship possible. One cannot simultaneously be in the most fulfilling, loving relationship possible while being alienated, isolated, and alone. They're just logically exclusive categories. And so what happens in Christology is that God empties himself of the properties of divinity by leaving the fullness of the unity. He also effectuates the atonement because he learns what it is to be fully human. He learns what it is to overcome the alienation and separation that we are heir to as humans. That's what the atonement does. It heals this relationship. And so the relational view of the atonement that I have laid out, what I have called the compassion theory of atonement, aligns with this view very easily, that because what we're doing is overcoming our alienation, is what Christ did first in giving up the fullness of divinity, leaving behind the fullness of this glory and the fullness of this unity and divine love, becoming alienated, isolated, even rejected, possibly more so than we'll ever know or could even comprehend. But he then overcame that with his love. And so the theory of atonement is also a theodicy, where the purpose of explaining evil in the world isn't to justify evil, but to heal it, to transform it, to redeem it. And so all of these views that I've presented are simply logical corollaries of this very simple view of the Godhead, where divinity arises from the loving relationship that they have with each other. And so I think it's a theological breakthrough. I don't believe it's my theological breakthrough. I believe it's Joseph Smith's. And the opposite, the model that we get of a college student leaving home to go live on his own, get married, and fly out to the stars that haven't been quite organized yet and take his wives with him where he can have children, is exactly the opposite of what the scriptures actually teach about being divine. Being divine is not to be isolated and separated and alone. It is to be interpersonally related in an indwelling relationship of unity. And so that model is exactly backwards. And so I believe what the scriptures are teaching, and clearly what was taught in Joseph Smith's revelations, and clearly even more what was taught in the lectures on faith, is this view of the Godhead in which divinity arises from the relationship.
Okay. So I guess, yeah, that makes sense. But again, let me repeat it back to you. One of the hallmarks of Mormonism or Latter-day Saint thought that, a lot of other Christians will try to point out as a heresy, if you will, but they say, oh, you believe that you're going to be equal with God, or you're going to become a God. So what you're saying is that humans, since there is no ontological gap in this view, so rather than us traditionally in Elias thought, you progress your character until you are like a godly type character, and maybe it's kind of that, but what you're saying is it's an emergent property of the kind of beings that we are and that God is. And when we have a certain type of relationship with each other, the divinity or godliness emerges when you enter into that relationship in, I guess you could say, the right way. And if that is the case, then one can see how a lot of Joseph Smith's teachings and practices all kind of point to that. For example, and I'm sure you'll get into this a bit later, but I don't want to get into the nuances of this, but ceilings and marriages were a little bit different in the earlier days when Joseph Smith was introducing them. For example, men could be sealed to other men, like kind of a leader. You'd seal yourself to someone, and that was the idea. But anyway, he had this idea of this great chain of everyone being connected and sealed to one another, and they do it through a ritual process and through the temple ordinances. You can get sealed to other people, and that's kind of how he did it. So he had this vision of this great unity of all the beings ever, that they're all sealed to one another, that everyone's connected. And so you can see the similarities, or I guess the evidences to what you're positing, that that is what Joseph Smith had in mind, or that is what was being revealed to him, that everyone, rather than being a separate entity, sometime in the distant future, will be a connected. He had all of humanity being one. That's what Zion is. That's what the point of the temple was. And that's what point of ceilings is. Is that kind of on the right track there?
Everything you've said is precisely correct. Everything that Joseph Smith taught and did was aimed at teaching us how to be in this relationship. It was aimed at teaching us how to love one another in a way that we would be fit for this relationship. The sealing power is the power of deification. It's the power of eternal families, and eternal families are the power of being together in an indwelling, unifying love forever with God. And so everything that Joseph Smith is doing ritually, the core of his social teachings and the concept of Zion, the basis of his teachings about Christ and so forth, all point to this kind of relationship. And not merely that, but that the real notion of God is not some independent being flying off to a separate planet that hasn't been quite organized yet, but of growing in this interpersonal relationship. And so often what Mormonism is taken to teach is exactly the opposite of what Joseph Smith was actually teaching. And I've been at pains to point that out, and how most Mormons historically, I think, have misunderstood Joseph Smith. I don't think that they've grasped this unifying dimension of his thought and the way that it coheres. And so it's really not a very difficult way of understanding and seeing what Joseph Smith is doing and what he's about, and that the unifying force of everything that he's doing is his view that we have been invited into the Godhead to be just as they are. And so this is so inspiring to me. This puts everything into perspective for me about what really matters. It makes sense of virtually everything he taught, in my view. And it makes sense of everything in the gospel, all pointing toward ultimately the love that Jesus taught us about. And so, in my view at least, the view of the Godhead as unifying love and of human beings being invited to join in this love by keeping the commandments, and they all boil down to this commandment to love one another as he loves us, that is the basis of the gospel. And it's the implicit message that our greatest fulfillment and happiness is found in loving relationships. We just happen to be the kind of beings that thrive in these kind of loving relationships. Now, that doesn't take away our individuality any more than an atom of oxygen ceases to be an atom of oxygen in water. Nor does it mean we don't have unique gifts to give to each other that nobody else has to give. That's not what is being taught. But this unity of relationship is something that enhances our individuality in this sense. It makes it so that the individual gifts that we have to give are increased and enhanced and made divine. And so the bottom line is that this is a unifying view of Christology, of his view of deification, of the rituals that he performed, all of which are a form of Christification, by the way, and the social order of Zion and the order of the family being the basis of exaltation. And also what he was after in marriage between a man and a woman, because nothing in human experience comes closer to being in this relationship than a truly loving relationship between a husband and wife, especially the creative relationship where we are productive and creative of new life in our own likeness and image. And we've discussed all this before. It's all inherent in what I've already discussed. But this is all very simple. It's not hard. This just brings everything into focus. And so the peer relationship is Christology is kind of also the peer relationship is the key to everything that Joseph Smith ever thought or taught. And may I add, I truly believe this, the key to what Jesus Christ was teaching. He was teaching us to love as he does, to be in this relationship with the Father with this fullness of glory. That was the total burden of what he was teaching us to do and be. It means in our daily lives treating each other with kindness and love and looking for ways that we can serve people. It's what makes sense of the entire gospel, and it makes what matters ultimately also matters presently. And Joseph Smith's theology and what Christ did in resurrection and with his life means that those things that matter most are not at the mercy of those things which matter least. And so ultimately, I think that this is also an ethic, and I've derived an ethic from this nature of relationship, by the way, the agape ethic. And so this also unifies everything that I'm doing and saying in my theology. But you see, it's a very simple, logically interlocking group of ideas that aren't hard to understand. It's not hard to see how they fit together. And it's not hard to see how they lead immediately to the essence of the Christian gospel and what is being taught and why it's being taught and why it's so important. And so to contemplate this, I think just to spend a little bit of time with these ideas is itself, at least to me, it's very inspiring, and it always inspires me with love and then to seek and look outwardly to bless the lives of others with the gifts that God has given me. This is a subject that is near and dear to my heart and one that resonates deeply in my heart that I think that I can share because I see it in maybe a unique way. I don't know if I do. Maybe everybody else has seen it and I'm just coming to the scene lately. But the bottom line is that this vision is the most worthy vision. We don't know of anything more valuable or even potentially more valuable than the loving relationships that are being pointed to in the pure relationship is Christology.
All right, and then, yeah, you end this chapter with a nice little couplet, and I'll share that, and then if you want to say anything about that, you can, but if not, that's fine. You say, Christ became our peer in all things so that we might become his peers in all things.
Yeah, you know, channeling President Snow in his couplet, as man now is, God once was, as God now is, man may be. Also a good summary. And maybe this is just kind of a good place to summarize and say that a part of the burden of what I've wanted to get out there is that I think the most Mormons and most people seeing Mormonism have misunderstood Joseph Smith's message to see it as exactly the opposite of what it is. It is not about independence and going out there all alone and just living long enough and becoming God. If you just learn enough and become a great enough scientist, that's not what it's about at all. At the very center of it is something much more valuable.
Thank you for joining us. To support the podcast, donate at exploringmormonthought.com. Follow us on facebook.com/exploringmormonthought.